I can't insanely rush to help Ciri. I can't run and save Geralt and Yennefer like a madwoman. But that's not all. In the war being waged, in the war to which you sent your girls, in the war to which Yara fled, I'm even refused the chance to stand on the hill. To stand on the hill once more. This time with the awareness of a truly conscious and correct decision.
Everybody has their own decision and their own hill, Triss, said the High Priestess softly. Everybody. You can't run away from yours either.
There was a commotion in the entrance to the tent. Another casualty was being carried in, accompanied by several knights. One, in full plate armour, was shouting, giving orders and urging the carriers on.
Move, stretcher bearers, quicker! Put him here! Here! Hey, you, medic! I'm busy.
Rusty didn't even look up.
Please put the wounded man on a stretcher. I'll see to him when I finish. You'll see to him immediately, stupid leech, for it is none other than the most honourable Count of Garamond. This hospital...
Rusty raised his voice, angry, because the broken arrowhead stuck in the casualty's guts had once again slipped out of his forceps.
This hospital has very little in common with democracy. They mainly bring in knights and upward, barons, counts, marquises, and various others of that ilk. Somehow, few care about wounded men of humbler birth. But there is some kind of equality here, nonetheless. That is on my table. Hey, you what? It doesn't matter.
Rusty once again stuck a cannula and a pair of forceps into the wound.
If this one here, from whose guts I'm removing bits of iron, is a peasant, a member of the minor gentry, old nobility or aristocracy, he's lying on my table. And to me, as I hum to myself, a duke's worth a jester. Before God, we're all equally wise and equally foolish. You what? Your count will have to wait his turn. You confounded halfling! Help Mishani take the other forceps. Look out for that artery. Marty, just a little more magic, if you would. We have serious hemorrhaging here.
The knight took a step forward, teeth and armour grating.
I'll have you hanged, he roared. I'll order you hanged, you unhuman.
Silence, Batbrock,
the wounded count said with difficulty, biting his lips.
Silence! Leave me, and get back to the fighting.
No, my lord, never. That was an order.
A thudding and clanging of iron, the snorting of horses and wild cries reached their ears from behind the tent flap. The wounded in the field hospital moaned in various keys.
Please look.
Rusty raised his forceps, showing the splintered arrowhead he had finally extracted.
A craftsman made this trinket, supporting a large family thanks to its manufacture. Furthermore, contributing to the growth of small craft work, and thus also to general prosperity and universal happiness. And the way this ornament clings to human guts is surely protected by a patent. Long live progress.
He casually threw the bloody blade into the bin and glanced at the casualty, who had fainted during the operation.
Sew him up and take him away, he nodded. If he's lucky, he'll survive. Bring me the next in the queue, the one with the gashed head.
That one, Marty Södergren said calmly, just gave up his place a moment ago.
Rusty sucked in and exhaled, moved away from the table without unnecessary comments, and stood over the wounded count. Rusty's hands were bloody, and his apron splashed with blood like a butcher. Daniel Echeverry, the Count of Garamond, paled even more.
Well, panted Rusty, it's your turn, your grace. Put him on the table. What do we have here? Ah, nothing remains of that joint that could be saved. It's porridge. It's pulp. What do you whack each other with, Count, that you smash each other's bones like that? Well, it'll hurt a bit, your grace. It'll hurt a bit. But please, don't worry. It'll be just like it is in a battle. Tourniquet. Knife. We're going to amputate, your grace.
Daniel Echeverry, the Count of Garamond, who had put a brave face on it until then, howled like a wolf. Before he clenched his jaws from the pain, Sharni quickly slipped a peg of lindenwood between his teeth. Your Royal Highness, Lord Constable.
Talk, lad.
The Volunteer Regiment and the Free Company are holding the defile near Golden Pond. The dwarves and condottieri are holding fast, although they're awfully bloodied. They say a Duke of Pangrat's dead. Frontino's dead. Julia Abatamarco's dead. All of them, all dead. The Dorian Company, which came to relieve them, is slaughtered.
Reserves, my Lord Constable,
Foltest said quietly, but clearly. If you want to know my opinion, it's time to send in the reserves. Have Bronibor throw his infantry at the Blackcloaks. Now, forthwith. Otherwise they'll dismember our lines, and that means the end.
Jan Natalis didn't answer, now observing the next liaison officer rushing towards them from a distance on a horse, spraying flecks of foam.
Get your breath back, lad. Get your breath back and speak concisely.
They've breached the front. The elves of the Vrihedd Brigade. Graf de Reuter informs your graces that...
What does he inform us?
Talk. That it's time to save your lives.
Jan Natalis raised his eyes heavenwards.
Blenkert, he said hollowly. May Blenkert come now. Or may the night come.
The ground around the tent trembled beneath hooves, and the tent walls, it seemed, billowed from the intensity of the cries and the neighing of horses. A soldier rushed into the tent, followed close behind by two orderlies.
People flee! The soldier bellowed. Save yourselves! Nilfgaard is vanquishing our army! Destruction! Destruction! Defeat!
Clamp!
Rusty withdrew his face before the stream of blood, a potent and vivid fountain squirting from an artery.
Clamp and a compress. Clamp, Shani. Marty, do something if you would about that bleeding.
Someone howled like an animal right beside the tent, briefly, stopping abruptly. A horse squealed. Something hit the ground with a clank and a thud. A crossbow bolt punctured the canvas with a crack, hissed and flew out the other side. Fortunately too high to threaten the wounded men lying on stretchers.
Nilfgaard!
The soldier shouted again, in a high, trembling voice.
Gentlemen medics, can't you hear what I'm saying? Nilfgaard has breached the royal line. They're coming and murdering. Flee!
Rusty took a needle from Marty Södergren and put in the first suture. The man being operated on hadn't moved for a long time, but his heart was beating. Visibly.
I don't want to die,
yelled one of the conscious wounded. The soldier cursed, dashed for the exit, suddenly yelled, crashed backwards, splashing blood, and tumbled onto the dirt floor. Yola, kneeling by the stretchers, leapt to her feet and stepped back. It suddenly went quiet.
Not good,
thought Rusty, seeing who was entering the tent. Elves. Silver lightning bolts. The Vrihedd Brigade. The notorious Vrihedd Brigade.
A field hospital,
the first of the elves stated. He was tall, with a pretty, oval, expressive face, with large cornflower blue eyes.
Treating the wounded.
No one said anything. Rusty felt his hands begin to tremble. He quickly handed the needle to Marty. He saw Shani's forehead and the bridge of her nose pale.
So, what's this about?
Said the elf, drawling his words menacingly.
Why do we wound our foes over there on the battlefield? Over there, in the fighting, we inflict wounds so men will die from them. And you treat them. I observe an absolute lack of logic here. And a conflict of interests.
He stooped over and thrust his sword, almost without a swing, into the chest of the casualty on the stretcher nearest the entrance. Another elf pinned another wounded man with a half-pike. A third casualty, conscious, tried hard to stop a thrust with his left arm and the heavily bandaged stump of his right. Shani screamed, shrilly, piercingly, drowning out the heavy, inhuman groaning of the mutilated man being murdered. Yola, throwing herself onto a stretcher, covered the next casualty with her body. Her face blanched like the linen of a bandage, and her mouth began to twitch involuntarily. The elf squinted his eyes.
Va fort, Bianna, he barked, or I'll run you through along with this doina. Get out of here.
Rusty was beside Yola in three bounds, shielding her.
Get out of my tent, you murderer. Get back there to the battlefield. Your place is there among the other murderers. Murder each other there, if that is your will. But get out of here.
The elf looked down at the pot-bellied halfling, shaking with fear, the top of whose curly mop reached a little above his waist.
Blood, Therian, he hissed. Tawdy to humans, get out of my way. Not a chance.
The halfling's teeth were chattering, but his words were distinct. The second elf leapt forward and pushed the surgeon with the shaft of his half-pike. Rusty fell to his knees. The tall elf wrenched Yola away from the wounded man with a brutal tug and raised his sword, and froze, seeing on the rolled-up cloak under the injured man's head the silver flames of the Dithwin division and the insignia of a colonel.
Yavin!
Screamed an elf woman with dark hair woven into a plait, rushing into the tent.
Came below! Edavagiri the Doina, Ean va! His teeth!
The tall elf looked at the wounded colonel for a moment, then at the eyes of the surgeon, which were watering in terror. Then he turned on his heel and left. Once again, the tramping of hooves, yelling and the clanging of iron could be heard from beyond the wall of the tent.
How about the black cloaks? Murder!
A thousand voices yelled. Someone howled like an animal, and the howling transformed into macabre wheezing. Rusty tried to stand up, but his legs failed him. His arms weren't much use either. Yola, trembling with powerful spasms of suppressed tears, curled up by the stretcher of the wounded Nilfgaardian in a fetal position. Shani was crying, not trying to hide her tears, but still holding the retractors. Marty was calmly putting in sutures, only her mouth moving in a kind of mute, silent monologue. Rusty, still unable to stand up, sat back down. He met the gaze of the orderly, huddled and squeezed into a corner of the tent.
Give me a swig of hooch, said Rusty with effort. Just don't say you don't have any. I know you rascals. You always do.
General Blenheim Blenkert stood up in his stirrups, stuck his neck out like a crane, and listened to the sounds of the battle.
Draw out the array, he ordered his commanders, and we'll go at a trot at once behind that hill. From what the scouts say, it appears that we'll come out straight on the Blackcoat's right wing.
And we'll give them what for?
One of the lieutenants, a whippersnapper with a silky and very spare little moustache, shouted shrilly. Blenkert looked askance at him.
A detachment with a standard at the head, he ordered, drawing his sword. And in the charge, cry, Redania. Cry it at the top of your lungs. May Faltist and Natalis's boys know that the relief is coming.
Graf Cobus de Reuter had fought in various battles for 40 years since he was 16. Furthermore, he was an 8th-generation soldier. Without doubt, he had something in his genes. Something that meant that the roar and hubbub of battle, for everyone else, simply a horrifying hullabaloo that drowned out everything else, was like a symphony, like a concert for a full orchestra to Cobus de Reuter. De Reuter had once heard other notes, chords and tones.
Hurrah, boys! He roared, brandishing his baton. Redania! Redania is coming! The eagles! The eagles!
From the north, from behind the hills, rolling towards the battle, came a mass of cavalry, over which an amaranth pennant and a great gonfalon with a silver Redanian eagle fluttered.
Relief! Yelled de Reuter. The relief's coming! Hurrah! Death to the black cloaks!
The 8th-generation soldier immediately noticed that the Nilfgaardian wing was wheeling around, trying to turn towards the charging relief with a disciplined, tight front. He knew he could not allow them to do that.
Follow me! He roared, wresting the standard from the standard-bearer's hands. Follow me! Traitorgorians, follow me!
They struck. They struck suicidally, dreadfully, but effectively. The Nilfgaardians of the Venendal division fell into confusion, and then the Redanian companies drove into them. A great shout rose into the sky. Gobus de Reuter didn't see or hear it. A stray bolt from a crossbow had struck him straight in the temple. The nobleman sagged in the saddle and fell from his horse, the standard covering him like a shroud. 8 generations of de Reuters, who had fallen fighting and were following the battle from the beyond, nodded in acknowledgement.
It could be said, Captain, that the Nodlings were saved by a miracle that day, or a coincidence that no one could have predicted. Admittedly, Restif de Montalon writes in his book that Marshal Couhon made a mistake in his assessment of the enemy's strength and plans, that he took too great a risk splitting up the center army group and setting off with a cavalry troop, that he took on a risky battle not having at least a threefold advantage, and that he neglected reconnaissance. He didn't uncover the Redanian army arriving with reinforcements.
Cadet Putkammer, Mr. de Montalon's work, which was of doubtful quality, is not included in this school's curriculum, and His Imperial Highness deigned to express himself extremely critically about the book. Thus, you will not quote it here, Cadet. Indeed, it astonishes me. Until now, your answers have been very good, positively excellent, and suddenly you begin to discourse about miracles and coincidences, while finally you take the liberty of criticizing the leadership abilities of Menno Couhorn, one of the greatest leaders the Empire has produced. Cadet Putkammer, and all the rest of you cadets, if you're seriously thinking about passing the final exam, you'll listen and remember. At the Battle of Brenner, no miracles or accidents were at work, but a conspiracy. Hostile saboteur forces, subversive elements, foul rabble-rousers, cosmopolites, political bankrupts, traitors and turncoats. A canker that was later burned out with white-hot iron. But before it came to that, those base traitors tangled up their own nation in spiderwebs and wove a snare of scheming. It was they who inveigled and betrayed Marshal Couhorn then, deceived him and misled him. It was they, scoundrels without faith or honor.
Whoresomes, repeated Menno Couhorn, without taking the telescope from his eye. Common whoresomes. But I'll find you, just wait. I'll teach you what reconnaissance means, de Wingelt. You will personally find the officer who was on the patrol beyond the hills to the north. Have all of them, the entire patrol, hanged.
Yes, sir. Ude de Wingelt, the marshal's aide-de-camp, clicked his heels together. He could not know that right then, Lamar Flout, the officer from the patrol, was dying, trampled by horses of the secret reserves of the Nordlings who were attacking the flanks, the reserves he hadn't uncovered. Neither could de Wingelt know that he only had 2 hours of life left.
How many of them are there, Mr. Trahe?
Couhorn didn't take the telescope from his eye, in your opinion.
At least 10,000, replied the commander of the 7th Deirlanian dryly. Mainly Redania, but I also see the chevron of Adirne. The unicorn is also there, so we also have Caedwen, with a detachment of at least a company.
The company was galloping. Sand and grit flew from beneath hooves.
"Forward, you duns!"
roared Centurion Halfpot, drunk as usual.
"Attack! Kill! Caedwen! Caedwen!"
"Damn it, but I'm dying for a piss," thought Zivik. "I should have gone before the battle."
Now there might not be a chance.
"Forward, you duns!"
Always the duns. Wherever things are going wrong, the duns. Who did they send as an expeditionary force to Temeria? The duns. Always the dun banner. I need a piss.
They arrived. Zivik yelled, turned around in the saddle, and slashed backhand, destroying the spaulder and shoulder of a horseman in a black cloak with an 8-pointed silver star.
"The duns! Caedwen! Fight! Kill!"
The dun banner standard struck Nilfgaard with a thud, a clatter and a clank, amidst the roars of soldiers and the squeals of horses.
"De Melis Stoke and Brabant will cope with that relief," said Ilan Trahe, the commander of the 7th Deirlanian Brigade, calmly. "The forces are balanced. Nothing has gone wrong yet. Tyrconnel's division is counterbalancing the left wing. Manya and Verendal are managing on the right. And we can tip the scales, by striking the line going in after the elves."
Menno Couhorn understood at once. "By striking at the rear lines, sowing panic. That's it.
That's what we shall do by the great sun. To your companies, gentlemen. Now the Kea and the Seventh, your time has come.
Long live the Emperor! Yelled Gaze von Loo.
Lord de Wingelt. The Marshal turned around. Please muster the adjutants and the guard troop. Enough inactivity. We are going to charge with the Seventh Derelenian.
Uda de Wingelt paled slightly, but immediately regained control.
Long live the Emperor! He cried,
and there was almost no tremor in his voice.
Rusty cut, and the wounded man wailed and scratched the table. Yola, bravely fighting giddiness, was taking care of the tourniquets and clamps. Shani's raised voice could be heard from the entrance to the tent.
Where? Are you insane? The living are waiting to be saved here, and you're marching in with corpses?
But this is Baron Anselm Aubrey himself, Madam Medic, the company commander.
It was the company commander, now it's a corpse. You only managed to bring him in one piece because his armour is watertight. Take him away. This is a field hospital, not a mortuary.
But, Madam Medic, don't block the entrance. Look there, they're carrying one that's still breathing.
Or at least he looks like he's still breathing, because it might just be wind.
Rusty snorted, but immediately afterwards raised an eyebrow.
Shani, come here at once. Remember your chit, he said through clenched teeth, bending over the mutilated leg, that a surgeon can only take the liberty of cynicism after 10 years of experience. Will you remember that?
Yes, Mr. Rusty.
Take the raspberry and strip off the periosteum. Blast! It would be worth anaesthetizing him a little more. Where's Marty?
She's puking outside the tent, said Shani, without a trace of cynicism. Puking her guts out.
Sorcerers!
Rusty took hold of a saw.
Instead of thinking up numerous awful and powerful spells, they would be better thinking up one. One that would enable them to cast minor spells, for example, anaesthetizing ones, without difficulty and without puking.
The saw grated and crunched on bone. The wounded man moaned.
Tighten the tourniquet, Yula.
The bone finally gave way. Rusty tidied it up with a small chisel and wiped his forehead.
Blood vessels and nerves, he said mechanically and needlessly,
because before he had finished the sentence, the girls were already putting in the sutures. He removed the severed leg from the table and threw it down onto a pile of other severed limbs. The wounded man hadn't roared or moaned for some time.
Fainted or dead?
Fainted, Mr. Rusty.
Good. Sew up the stump, Shani. Bring on the next one. Yola, go and find out if Marty has puked everything up.
I wonder,
said Yola very quietly, without raising her head.
How many years of experience you have, Mr. Rusty? 100?
After a quarter of an hour of strenuous marching and choking on dust, the yells of the centurions and decurions ceased, and the Vachemian regiments spread out in a line. Yara, gasping and gulping in air through his mouth like a fish, saw Voivode Bronibor strutting before the front on his beautiful armoured steed. The Voivode himself was also in full plate armour. His armour was enamelled in blue stripes, making Bronibor look like a great steel-plated mackerel.
How are you, you dolts?
The rows of pikemen answered with a rumbling growl like distant thunder.
You're issuing farting sounds,
the Voivode noted, reining his armoured horse around and directing him to walk before the front.
That means you're feeling good. When you're feeling bad, you don't fart in hushed tones, but you wail and howl like the damned. It's clear from your expressions that you're spoiling for a fight, that you're dreaming of battle, that you can't wait to get your hands on the Nilfgaardians. Right, you Vachemian brigands? Then I have good news for you. Your dream will come true in a short while. In a very short while.
The pikeman muttered again. Bronibor, after riding to the end of the line, turned around and spoke on, wrapping his mace against the ornamental pommel of his saddle.
You stuffed yourselves with dust, infantry, marching behind the armoured troops. Up until now, instead of glory and spoils, you've been sniffing horses' farts. And even today, when a great battle is upon us, you almost didn't make it to the field. But you managed it, so I congratulate you with all my heart. Here, outside this village, whose name I've forgotten, you will finally show how much worth you have as an army. That cloud you see on the battlefield is the Nilfgaardian horse, which means to crush our army with a flanking strike. Shove us and drown us in the bogs of this little river, whose name I have also forgotten. The honour of defending the breach that has arisen in our ranks has fallen to you, celebrated Vecimian pikeman, by the grace of King Foltest and Constable Natalis. You will close that breach, so to speak, with your breasts. You will stop the Nilfgaardian charge. You're rejoicing, comrades, what? You're bursting with pride, eh?
Yara, squeezing his pike staff, looked around. There was nothing to indicate that the soldiers were rejoicing at the prospect of the imminent battle, and if they were bursting with pride by virtue of the honour of closing the breach, they were skilfully disguising it. Melfi, standing on the boy's right, was mumbling a prayer under his breath. On his left, Doislax, a hardened professional soldier, sniffed, swore, and coughed nervously. Bronibor reined his horse around and sat up straight in the saddle.
"I can't hear you," he roared. "I asked if you're bursting with fucking pride."
This time the pikemen, seeing no alternative, roared with one great voice that they were. Yara also roared. If everyone was, he might as well too.
"Good."
The voivode reined back his horse before the front.
"And now, stand in an orderly array. Centurions, what are you waiting for fuck's sake? Form a square. The first rank kneels, the second stands. Ground your pikes. Not that end, ass. Yes, yes, I'm talking to you, you horrible little man. Higher. Hold your pike staff higher, you wretches. Close ranks. Close up. Close ranks. Shoulder to shoulder. Well, now you look impressive. Almost like an army."
Yara found himself in the second rank. He pushed the butt of his pike into the ground and gripped the pike staff in his hands, sweaty from fear. Melfi was muttering indistinctly, repeating various words over and over, mainly concerning the private lives of the Nilfgaardians, dogs, bitches, kings, constables, voivodes, and all their mothers. The cloud in the battlefield grew.
"Don't fart there! Don't chatter your teeth!" roared Bronibor. "Thoughts of frightening the Nilfgaardian horses with those noises are misguided. Let no man deceive himself. What is heading for you are the Nausicaa and the 7th Delanian Brigades. Splendid, valiant, superbly trained soldiers. They can't be scared. They can't be defeated. They have to be killed. Hold those pikes higher."
From a distance, the still soft but growing thud of hooves could now be heard. The ground began to shudder. Blades began to glint like sparks in the cloud of dust.
"It's your good fucking fortune, Vecimians," the voivode roared once more, "that the standard infantry pike of the new modernized model is 21 feet long, and a Nilfgaardian sword is 3.5 feet long. Can you reckon? Know that they can too. But they are counting on your not holding out, that your true nature will emerge, that it will be confirmed and revealed that you are shitheads, cowards, and mangy sheepshaggers. The black cloaks are counting on you to throw down your poles and start running, and they will pursue you across the battlefield and hack you on the backs, heads, and necks. Hack you comfortably and with no difficulty. Remember, you little shits, that although fear lends the heels extraordinary speed, you won't outrun cavalrymen. Whoever wants to live, whoever wants glory and spoils, must stand. Stand firm. Stand like a wall and close ranks."
Yara looked back. The crossbowmen standing behind the line of pikemen were already winding their cranks, and the interior of the square was bristling with the points of guisarme, ranceurs, halberds, glaives, partisans, scythes, and pitchforks. The ground trembled more and more distinctly and powerfully, and it was already possible to discern the shapes of horsemen in the black wall of cavalry hurtling towards them.
"Mama, dear mother," repeated Melfi through trembling lips. "Mama, dear mother."
"Fucker," mumbled Doislax.
The hoofbeats intensified. Yara wanted to lick his lips, but he couldn't. His tongue had gone stiff. His tongue stopped behaving normally. It had stiffened strangely and was as dry as a bone. The hoofbeats intensified.
"Close ranks!" roared Bronibor, drawing his sword. "Feel your comrade's shoulder. Remember, none of you is fighting alone. and the only remedy for the fear you're feeling is the pike in your fist. Prepare to fight. Pikes aimed at the horses' chests. What are we going to do, Virginia brigands? I'm asking.
Stand firm,
roared the pikemen with one voice.
Stand like a wall. Close ranks.
Yara also roared. If everyone was, he might as well too. Sand, grit and turf sprayed from beneath the hooves of the advancing wedge of cavalry. The charging horsemen yelled like demons, brandishing their weapons. Yara leaned onto his pike, buried his head in his shoulders, and shut his eyes. Yara shooed away a wasp circling above his inkwell with a violent movement of his stump, without interrupting his writing.
Marshal Kuhorn came to nothing. His flanking troop was stopped by the heroic Vichemian infantry under Voivode Bronibor, paying in blood for his heroism. And at the moment the Vichemians resisted, Nilfgaard fell into confusion on the left wing. Some of them began to take flight, others to pull together and defend themselves in groups surrounded on all sides. Soon after, the same thing happened on the right wing, where the doggedness of the dwarves and condottieri finally overcame Nilfgaard's assault. A single great cry of triumph went up along the entire front, and a new spirit entered the royal knights. And the spirit fell in the Nilfgaardians. Their hands weakened, and our men began to shell them like peas, so loudly it echoed. And Field Marshal Menno Kuhorn understood that the battle was lost, saw the brigades perishing and falling into confusion around him. And then his officers and knights ran to him, giving him a fresh horse, calling for him to flee and save his own life. But a fearless heart beat in the breast of the Nilfgaardian field marshal. "That will not do," he called, pushing away the reins held out towards him. "It will not do for me to flee like a coward from the field on which so many good men under my command have fallen for the Emperor." And the doughty Menno Kuhorn added,
"Besides, now there's nowhere to fuck off to," Menno Kuhorn added calmly and soberly, looking around the battlefield. "They're surrounding us on all sides."
"Give me your cloak and helmet, sir." Captain Sievers wiped blood and sweat from his face. "Take mine, sir. Dismount your steed and take mine. Don't protest. You must live, sir. You're indispensable to the Empire. Irreplaceable. We Derlanians will strike the Nordlings. We'll draw them to us. You, meanwhile, try to break through down there, below the fish pond."
"You won't get out of that alive," muttered Kuhorn, taking the reins being offered to him.
"It's an honor." Sievers straightened up in the saddle. "I'm a soldier of the 7th Derlinians. To me, have faith. To me."
"Good luck," mumbled Kuhorn,
throwing over his back a Derlinian cloak with a black scorpion on the shoulder.
"Sievers." "Yes, sir, Marshal, sir."
"Nothing. Good luck, lad."
"And may luck be on your side, sir. To horse. Have faith."
Kuhorn watched them ride off. For a long while, until the moment Siva's small group rode with a bang, a yell and a thud into the condottieri, into a troop considerably outnumbering them, to whose aid, indeed, other troops hurried at once. The Daelanians' black cloaks vanished among the greyness of the condottieri. All was lost in the dust. The nervous coughing of De Vingalt and the adjutants brought Kuhorn to his senses. The marshal adjusted the stirrup leathers and flaps. He brought the restless steed under control.
"To horse," he commanded.
At first, things went well for them. In the mouth of the valley leading to the rivulet, a dwindling troop of survivors of the Nausicaa Brigade was doggedly defending itself, forced into a circle bristling with blades, onto which the Nordlings had concentrated all their momentum and force, making a breach in the ring. Naturally, they didn't get away totally unscathed. They had to hack their way through a row of light volunteer horse, probably Brigaean, judging by their insignia. The skirmish was very short, but furiously fierce. Kuhorn had already lost and discarded all remains and appearances of lofty heroism, and now just wanted to survive. Not even looking back at his escort, trading vicious blows with the Brigaeans, he rushed towards the stream with his adjutants, pressing himself to and hugging the horse's neck. The way was clear. Beyond the little river, beyond the crooked willows, a barren plain spread out, on which no enemy troops could be seen. Uda de Vingalt, galloping beside Kuhorn, also saw it and yelled triumphantly. Prematurely. A meadow covered in bright green knotgrass separated them from the sluggish, murky little river. When they charged into it at full gallop, the horses suddenly plunged up to their bellies in the bog. The marshal flew over his steed's head and fell headfirst into the bog. All around, horses were neighing and kicking, and men covered in mud and green duckweed were yelling. Menno suddenly heard another sound amidst this pandemonium, a sound that meant death, the hiss of fletchings. He dashed for the current of the small river, wading up to his hips in the thick marsh. An adjutant, forcing his way through beside him, suddenly tumbled face first into the mud, and the marshal saw a bolt stuck into his back up to the fletchings. At that same moment, he felt a terrible blow to the head. He staggered, but didn't fall, stuck in the mud and swamp. He wanted to scream, but only managed to splutter. "I'm alive," he thought, trying to wriggle out of the clutch of the sticky slime. A horse struggling out of the marsh had kicked him in the helmet, and the deeply dented metal had shattered his cheek, knocked out some teeth and cut his tongue. "I'm bleeding. I'm swallowing blood. But I'm alive." Once again, the slap of bowstrings, the hiss of fletchings, the thud and crack of arrowheads penetrating armour. Yells, the neighing of horses, squelching and blood splashing. The marshal looked back and saw bowmen on the bank. Small, stocky, pot-bellied shapes in mail shirts, bassinets and pointed chick-chacks. Dwarves, he thought. The slap of bowstrings, the whistle of bolts, the squeal of horses threshing around, the yelling of men choking on water and mud. Uda de Vingalt, turning towards the marksman, cried in a high, squeaky voice that he was surrendering, asking for mercy and compassion, promised a ransom, and begged for his life. Aware that no one understood his words, he raised his sword, held by the blade above his head. He held the weapon out towards the dwarves in the international, outright cosmopolitan gesture of surrender. He wasn't understood, or was misunderstood. For two bolts slammed into his chest with such force that the impact hurled him up out of the bog. Kuhorn tore the dented helmet from his head. He knew the common speech of the Nordlings quite well.
"I'm Marshal Kuhorn," he mumbled, spitting blood. "Marshal Kuhorn, I surrender. Mercy, mercy."
"What's he saying, Zoltan?" one of the crossbowmen asked in surprise. "Bugger him and his chattering. Do you see the embroidery on his cloak, Munro?" "A silver scorpion. Ah! Wallop the horse, son, boys. For Caleb Stratton. For Caleb Stratton."
Bowstrings clanged. One bolt hit Kuhorn straight in the chest, the second in the hip, and the third in the collarbone. The Nilfgaardian field marshal fell over backwards in the watery marsh, the knot grass and swamp yielding under his weight.
"Who the bloody hell could Caleb Stratton be?" he managed to think. "I've never heard of any Caleb."
The murky, viscous, muddied and bloodied water of the River Chotla closed over his head and gushed into his lungs. She went outside the tent to get some fresh air, and then she saw him sitting beside the blacksmith's bench.
"Yara!"
He raised his eyes towards her. There was emptiness in those eyes.
"Yola?"
he asked, moving his swollen lips with difficulty.
"How come you're... What a question!"
she interrupted him at once. "You'd better tell me how you've ended up here."
"We've brought our commander, Voivod Bronibor. He's wounded. You're also wounded. Show me that hand. Oh, goddess. But you'll bleed to death, lad."
Yara looked at her, and Yola suddenly began to doubt whether he could see her.
"It's a battle," said
the boy, teeth chattering slightly.
"He must
stand like a wall. Steady in the line. The lightly wounded are to carry the heavily wounded to the field hospital. It's an order. Show me your hand.
Yara howled briefly, his clenching teeth snapping in a wild staccato. Yola frowned.
Oh, my. It looks dreadful. Oh, dear, Yara. Yara, you'll see. Mother Neneka will be angry. Come with me.
She watched him blanch when he saw it, when he smelled the stench hanging beneath the roof of the tent. He staggered. She held him up. She saw him looking at the bloodied table, at the man lying there, at the surgeon, a small halfling who suddenly leapt up, stamped his feet, cursed foully, and threw a scalpel on the ground.
Damn it! Fuck it! Why is it like this? Why does it have to be like this?
No one replied to the question.
Who was it?
Voivode Pronibor,
explained Yara in a feeble voice, looking straight ahead with his empty gaze.
Our commander. We stood firm in the line. It was an order, like a wall. And they killed Melfi. Mr. Rusty, Yola asked, this boy's a friend of mine. He's wounded.
He's on his feet, the surgeon assessed coldly. And here there's a dying man waiting for a trepanation. There's no room here for any sentimental connections.
At that moment, Yara, with excellent timing, fainted dramatically and fell down on the dirt floor. The halfling snorted.
Oh, very well. On the table with him, he commanded. Oh-ho! A nicely smashed arm. I wonder what's holding it on. His sleeve, I think. Tourniquet, Yola. Tightly. And don't you dare cry. Shani, give me a saw.
The saw dug into the bone above the crushed elbow joint with a hideous crunching. Yara came to and bellowed, horribly but briefly. For when the bone gave way, he immediately fainted again.
And thus the might of Nilfgaard was reduced to dust on the Brenner battlefields, and an end was put to the march of the Empire northwards. Either by being killed or taken captive, the Empire lost 440,000 men at the Battle of Brenner. The flower of the knighthood and the elite cavalry fell. Leaders of the stature of Menno Cúchulainn, Briarbrand, de Melis Stoke, Van Loo, Tyrconnell, Egerbracht, and others whose names have not survived in our archives fell, were taken prisoner, or disappeared without trace. Thus did Brenner become the beginning of the end. But it behoves me to write that that battle was but a small stone in the building, and superficial would have been its importance had the fruits of the victory not been wisely taken advantage of. It behoves us to recall that instead of resting on his laurels and bursting with pride and awaiting honours and homage, Jan Natalis headed south almost without stopping. The cavalry troop under Adam Pangrat and Julia Abatimarco destroyed two divisions of the Third Army that had brought belated relief to Menno Cúchulainn, routing them such that nec nuntius clades. At news of this, the rest of the Centre Army group took miserable flight and fled in haste to the far side of the Euruga. And since Foltest and Natalis were on their heels, the Imperial forces lost entire convoys and all their siege engines, with which, in their hubris, they had meant to capture Vichima, Gorzvelen, and Novigrad. And like an avalanche rolling down from the mountains, becoming covered in more and more snow and becoming greater, so also Brenner caused more and more severe results for Nilfgaard. Hard times came for the Veden army under Duke de Vet, whom the corsairs from Skellige and King Ithain of Sidaris sorely vexed in a guerrilla war. When, meanwhile, de Vet learned about Brenner, when news reached him that King Foltest and Jan Natalis were marching briskly to him, he immediately ordered the trumpeting of the retreat and fled to Sintra, strewing the escape route with corpses, because at the news of the Nilfgaardian defeats
an insurrection in Verden flared up anew. Only in the undefeated strongholds of Nasthrog, Rosrog, and Bothrog did powerful garrisons remain, for which reason only after the Peace of Sintra did they leave honourably and with their standards intact. Whereas in Adian, the tidings about Brenna led to the feuding kings Demavend and Henselt shaking each other's right hands and taking arms against Nilfgaard together. The East Army Group, which, under the command of Duke Ardal Efdai, marched towards the Pontar Valley, did not manage to challenge the two allied kings. Strengthened by reinforcements from Redania and Queen Maeve's guerrillas, who had cruelly plundered Nilfgaard, Demavend and Henselt drove Ardal Efdai all the way to Aldersburg. Duke Ardal wanted to give battle, but by a strange twist of fate, he suddenly fell ill, having eaten something. He came down with the colic and diarrhea miserere, and thus, in 2 days, he died in great pain. And Demavend and Henselt, without delay, attacked the Nilfgaardians, also there at Aldersburg, evidently for the sake of historical justice, and they routed them in a decisive battle, though Nilfgaard still had a significant numerical advantage. Thus, through spirit and artistry, usually triumph over dull and brutal force. It behooves me to write about one more thing. What exactly happened to Menno Kuhorn himself at the Battle of Brenna, no one knows. Some say he fell and his body, unrecognized, was buried in a common grave. Others say he escaped with his life, but fearing imperial wrath, did not return to Nilfgaard, but hid in Brooklon among the dryads, and there became a hermit, letting his beard grow down to the ground, and there, shortly after, expired amidst his worries. A story circulates among simple folk that the marshal returned at night to the Brenna battlefield and walked among the burial mounds, wailing, "Give me back my legions," until finally he hanged himself on an aspen spike on the hill called Gibbet Hill because of that. And at night one can happen upon the ghost of the celebrated marshal among other apparitions that commonly haunt the battlefield.
"Grandfather Yara! Grandfather Yara!"
Yara raised his head from his papers and adjusted his spectacles, which were slipping down his sweaty nose.
"Grandfather Yara,"
his youngest granddaughter shouted in the upper register. She was a determined and bright six-year-old, who, thank the gods, had taken more after her mother, Yara's daughter, than his lethargic son-in-law.
"Grandfather Yara, Grandmother Lucienne told me to tell you that that's enough for today of that layabout scribbling and that tea's on the table."
Yara meticulously assembled the written sheets and corked the inkwell. Pain throbbed in the stump of his arm.
"The weather's changing," he thought. "There'll be rain."
"Grandfather Yara!
I'm coming, Ciri. I'm coming."
It was already well after midnight before they had dealt with the last casualties. They carried out the final operations by artificial light, first from an ordinary lamp and later using magic. Marty Södergren recovered after the crisis she had undergone, and although as pale as death, stiff and as unnatural in her movements as a golem, used her magic competently and effectively. The night was black when they exited the tent, and all four of them sat down leaning against the canvas. The plain was full of fires. Various fires, the stationary fires of camps, and the moving flames of torches. The night resounded with distant song, chanting, shouts and cheers. The night around them was also alive with the intermittent cries and groans of the wounded, the pleading and sighs of the dying. They didn't hear it. They had become accustomed to the sounds of suffering and dying, and those sounds were ordinary. Natural to them, as integrated into the night as the croaking of frogs in the marshes by the River Chotla, or the singing of cicadas in the acacia trees by Golden Pond. Marty Södergren sat in lyrical silence, resting on the halfling's shoulder. Yola and Shani, indifferent, cuddling one another, snorted from time to time with completely nonsensical laughter. Before they sat down against the tent, they had each drunk a cup of vodka, and Marty had treated all of them with her last spell. A cheering charm, typically used when extracting teeth. Rusty felt cheated by this treatment. The drink, combined with the magic, instead of relaxing him, had stupefied him. Instead of reducing his exhaustion, had increased it. Instead of giving oblivion, brought back memories.
It looks, he thought, as though the alcohol and magic have only acted as they were meant to on Yola and Shani.
He turned around, and in the moonlight saw sparkling, silvery tracks of tears on the girls' faces.
I wonder, he said, licking his numb, insensitive lips, who won this battle? Does anybody know?
Marty turned her face towards him, but remained silent. The cicadas were singing among the acacias, willows and alders by Golden Pond, and the frogs croaked. The wounded moaned, begged and sighed, and died. Shani and Yola giggled through their tears. Marty Södergren died 2 weeks after the battle. She began meeting an officer of the Free Company of Condottieri. She treated the affair lightheartedly, unlike the officer. When Marty, who liked change, began fraternizing with a Temerian cavalry captain, the condottiero, mad with jealousy, stabbed her with a knife. He was hanged for it, but it was impossible to save the healer. Rusty and Yola died a year after the battle, in Maribor, during the largest outbreak yet of an epidemic of viral hemorrhagic fever, a disease also called the Red Death, or, from the name of the ship it was brought on, Katrina's Plague. All the physicians and most of the priests fled from Maribor then. Rusty and Yola remained, naturally. They treated the sick because they were doctors. The fact that there was no cure for the Red Death was unimportant to them. They both became infected. He died in her arms in the powerful, confidence-inspiring embrace of her large, ugly, peasant hands. She died 4 days later, alone. Shani died 72 years after the battle, as the celebrated and universally respected retired dean of the Department of Medicine at the University of Oxenfurt. Generations of future surgeons used to repeat her famous joke. So red to red, yellow to yellow, white to white. It's sure to be fine. Almost no one noticed how, after delivering that witty anecdote, the dean always wiped away a furtive tear. Almost no one. The frogs croaked and the cicadas sang among the willows by Golden Pond. Shani and Yola giggled through their tears.
I wonder,
repeated Milo Vanderbeck, halfling, field surgeon, known as Rusty.
I wonder who won.
Rusty, Marty Södergren said lyrically. Believe me, in your shoes, it's the last thing I'd be worrying about.
Some of the flames were tall and strong, burning brightly and vividly, while others were tiny, flickering and quavering, and their light diminished and died. At the very end was but one tiny flame, so weak it barely flickered and glimmered, now struggling to flare up, now almost going out entirely.
"Whose is the dying flame?" asked the Witcher.
"Yours," Death replied.
Florence Delanoy, Fairy Tales and Stories. Chapter 9. The plateau, extending almost all the way to the distant mountain peaks, greyish-blue in the fog, was like an actual stone sea, here undulating in a hump or a ridge, there bristling with the sharp fangs of reefs. The impression was enhanced by shipwrecks. Dozens of wrecks, of galleys, galeasses, cogs, caravels, brigs, hulks, and longships. Some of them looked as though they had ended up there not long before. Others were piles of barely recognizable planks and ribs, clearly having lain there for decades, if not centuries. Some of the ships were lying keel up. Others, turned over on their sides, looked as though they had been tossed up by devilish squalls and storms. Still others gave the impression they were sailing, making away amidst that stone ocean. They stood even and straight, the chests of their figureheads proudly stuck out, their masts pointing to the zenith, the remains of sails, shrouds and stays fluttering. They even had their own ghostly crews. Skeletons jammed between rotten planks and entangled in ropes. Dead sailors, busy forever with endless navigation. Flocks of black birds flew up, cawing from the masts, yards, ropes and skeletons, alarmed by the appearance of the rider, frightened by the clack of hooves. For a moment they flecked the sky, circled in a flock over the edge of the cliff, at the bottom of which lay a lake as grey and smooth as quicksilver. On the edge could be seen a dark and gloomy stronghold, whose towers partly overlooked the graveyard of ships and were partly suspended over the lake, with its bastions embedded in the vertical rock. Kelpie danced, snorted, and pricked up her ears, alarmed by the wrecks, the skeletons, at the whole landscape of death, at the cawing black birds which had already returned, alighting again on the broken masts and cross-trees, on the shrouds and skulls. But if anyone ought to have been afraid there, it was the rider.
"Easy, Kelpie," said Ciri in a changed voice. "It's the end of the road. This is the right place and the right time."
She found herself outside a gate, God knows how, and emerged like an apparition from between the wrecks. The guards at the foot of the gate noticed her first, alarmed by the cawing of rooks, and now shouted, gesticulating and pointing at her, calling others. When she rode to the gatehouse, there was already a crush there, an excited hubbub. They were all staring at her. The few who knew her and had seen her before, like Boreas Munn and Dacre Siliphant, and the considerably more numerous of them who had only heard about her, newly recruited soldiers from Skellen, mercenaries and ordinary marauders from Ebbing and the surroundings, who were now looking in amazement at the ashen-haired girl with the scar on her face and the sword on her back, at the splendid black mare holding her head high and snorting, her horseshoes ringing on the flagstones of the courtyard. The hubbub died down. It became very quiet. The mare trotted, lifting her legs like a ballerina, her horseshoes ringing like a hammer on an anvil. This went on for a long time before her way was finally barred by crossed guisarmes and ronceurs. Someone reached out a hesitant and frightened hand towards the bridle. The mare snorted.
"Take me to the lord of this castle," the girl said confidently.
Boreas Munn, not knowing himself why he was doing it, held her stirrup steady and offered his hand. Others held the stamping and snorting mare.
"Do you recognize me, my lady?" Boreas asked softly. "For we've already met."
"Where?"
"On the ice."
She looked him straight in the eye.
"I didn't look at your face then, sir," she said unemotionally.
"You were the Lady of the Lake."
He nodded seriously.
"Why have you come here, girl? What for?"
"For Yennefer, and to claim my destiny."
"Claim your death, more like," he whispered. "This is Snigger Castle. In your place, I'd flee as far from here as you can."
She looked again, and Boreas at once understood what she meant to say with that look. Stefan Skellen appeared. He watched the girl for a long time, his arms crossed on his chest. Finally, he indicated with an energetic gesture that she was to follow him. She went without a word, escorted on all sides by armed men.
"A strange wench," muttered Boreas, and shuddered.
"Fortunately, she's no concern now," said Dacre Siliphant. I'm surprised at you for talking to her like that. It was she, the witch, who killed Vargas and Fripp, and later Ola Harsheim. Tawny Owl killed Harsheim.